This podcast is from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Emma Crow. Look, I'm no stranger to shift work, but staying awake all night presenting a radio show, that is new to me. And I'll be doing it for 3 nights in a row from tonight. So far, so good. I haven't nodded off just yet. I am feeling kind of wired, but I'm feeling perfectly awake. It has got me thinking, though. There are people who do this all the time, staying up all night working. You may be one of them. You might be working now. You might be on your way home from work or heading off for a shift. I'm just wondering how you deal with it. When do you sleep? When do you eat? Have you got it all down to a fine art? Are you using earplugs or noise-cancelling earphones when you're trying to sleep during the day? How do you make it dark enough? Do you try and get one big block of sleep or do you have a few naps through the day? And what do your pet hates? Garbage trucks, I'm thinking. Dogs, people partying, noisy neighbours. I'm going to ask for your tips later on. I'd really like to hear your strategies. First, though, Sally Ferguson joins me from Adelaide. She's a research professor at the Appleton Institute, which is a multidisciplinary research hub that specialises in sleep and all sorts of other things. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Emma.
Great to have your company this morning. We've woken you up to talk to us. We've put you on a shift.
Yes, you have. It is. I have done a lot of overnight studies in my early days as a researcher. I haven't been up at 3:30 in the morning for work for a while, so new experience for me. Rekindling some. I was going to say fond memories, but maybe not.
That's right. You can be your own research subject tonight. See how you go. See how it affects you. So, look, tell me about the Appleton Institute and what it does in this area of sleep.
So we do a bunch of different things at the Appleton, which is a part of Seeking University. I guess three main areas. The first one is questions that we have around understanding the sort of the basics of sleep, how sleep works, what happens when we don't get enough sleep, how we recover from sleep deprivation. And a lot of that work happens in the laboratory. We've got a six-bed sleep lab. At the Appleton, where we recruit willing participants to come and live with us for a while. Studies can range from sort of 3 days up to 14 or 15 days. We have people live in the lab with us, and we do various things to their sleep and their circadian rhythms and have a look at how their performance changes, what happens to their mood. Just starting to have a look now at metabolic changes, as you just talked about in the intro there, you know, understanding how people are eating on their shifts and what that's doing to metabolic function and that sort of thing. So that's probably one of the main areas, studies in the lab, understanding what sleep is doing and what happens when we don't have enough sleep.
So do you have six people at a time in beds? I'm guessing they're all in separate rooms in the lab.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. So yes, they have, our sleep lab is pretty well set up. I have individual bedrooms and little work areas where they either, you know, do their study or read or whatever when they're in between sessions, and en suites, and then there's shared meal room and meal spaces and that sort of thing.
And you send people in there to what? Prod them, go in, wake up and see what happens.
Usually we are keeping them awake rather than letting them sleep, which is probably ironic in a sleep lab.
Yeah.
But we manipulate time of day factors and how much sleep they can get, and have them sleep at different time of the day and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, test their reaction time and all that kind of stuff. How interesting.
And then, of course, our other big area is more in the applied settings. So we do a lot of work looking at how work patterns and sleep interact, what the effect of working at different times of the day has on sleep and all those other measures, performance, mood, metabolic, etc. And we work with a range of different organisations, traditional shift working industries like transport, aviation, mining, healthcare, and we help them with their roster design, and also have a look at fatigue management strategies beyond rosters, which I imagine we'll have a little bit of more of a talk about as we go.
Well, I think it sounds like you qualify to talk about this topic. Sounds like it's been your life's work. So I'd be very interested to hear what you've found out. I mean, we all know that sleep is important, but how important is it? I mean, what are the benefits of a good night's sleep?
It's one of the three pillars of healthy life, and I think that's probably something that people are understanding more and more. it's absolutely critical to human health and performance. We don't have all the answers about why we sleep, which is good. That means, you know, sleep researchers have got a job for a little while longer.
Yeah.
But we do know that it's if people don't get enough sleep, they don't perform well, they make mistakes, they get grumpy, mood changes happen, communication breaks down, things like that. And we know that chronic sleep loss, so a little bit of sleep lost each day, has the same effects on our performance and mood as losing a full night's sleep, for example. So studies in animals have shown that sleep loss can be very detrimental very quickly. Those studies do involve kind of keeping animals awake in a not terribly friendly way.
Yeah.
And they're old studies, not, they don't happen so much anymore. But you know, keep someone awake for long enough, and I imagine we'll hear some stories tonight, hoping to. Hallucinations, people kind of forget what they're doing, make mistakes, those sorts of things. So, and like, you know, there's some very cool new research coming out showing what goes on in during sleep in the brain, and some very recent work showing that during sleep, and it actually has to be during sleep, it doesn't happen when you're just resting or under anesthetic, the brain cleans itself. So toxins get cleaned out of the brain during some stages of sleep, which is just very cool. If anyone's interested in that, there's a very cool TED talk on it.
That is very interesting, isn't it? So yeah, it's crucial. And I know that people, when hearing you talk about those feelings of sleep deprivation, we've all felt it. When we've had a run of a few bad nights, there might be people listening to us right now who are up with a baby that's interrupting their sleep. And you just can't function at 100% when you haven't had a good night's sleep. What would you say the right amount of sleep is for the average adult?
We still say 7 to 9 hours is what the average adult needs. So, you know, average that, 8. The amount of sleep that adults get is closer to 7, maybe the high 6s hours. But if you let people sleep for as long as they want, and you do that by putting them in the lab and then kind of washing out their sleep deprivation, so you have them in the lab for a few days and you just let them sleep for as long as they want, they get closer to 8 hours, 8 and a bit hours. So there'll be a lot of people laughing right now.
Yeah.
Listening to this. Yeah.
That's right.
But 8 is,
that's the ideal.
Is what we need.
Yeah. And I mean, and this morning we're going to talk about, well, what if you can't do that, or what if your sleep has to happen at a time of day when we're not really built for it? So we're really interested in shift workers and how things go for them, because obviously changing the time of day when you sleep does cause huge differences in the quality of the sleep you can get. Is that right?
Yeah. So, and that happens because we are we're day active beings. Our circadian rhythms, which is our daily rhythms, are driven by a biological clock in our brain. Very cool. And the circadian clock and all the little clocks that we have in the rest of our body drive things like our core body temperature drops overnight. Our melatonin is released, which is a hormone that's produced in the pineal gland, and that's melatonin supports our sleep. So core body temperature down, melatonin up, all of our other systems drive us to sleep during the night hours. And in the same way, all those systems drive wake during the day hours. So we are programmed to sleep at nighttime. And so when we attempt to sleep during the day, which a lot of us need to, and I will have to today as well.
Sorry.
no, it'll probably just be a nap. It'll be a good excuse to have a nap at work, actually. when we're trying to sleep during the day, we're fighting a bunch of different sort of systems that are actually driving us to be awake. So it does mean that sleep can be shorter during the day compared to the night. We sleep a bit lighter, so we don't spend as much time in deep sleep, which means we are more easily woken by the garbage truck or the dog or the
three children
lawnmower, yep, which or people knocking on the door.
Yes.
And also that makes daytime sleep can be more fragmented as well. So more awakenings, people have to, you know, get up and go to the loo, they get hungry, those sorts of things. So yeah, daytime sleep is challenging.
What should people do if they are doing shift work? I'm doing this for 3 nights and I guess I can just do my best, just grab sleep when I can. It's a kind of a one-off thing. What about people who, this is their life, they're working overnight, say 4 or 5 or even more nights a week. So they are up all night and they need to sleep during the day. What strategies can they employ to actually, you know, get the most quality sleep, you know, the most sleep as possible and also quality sleep?
Yeah, so I think that the people figure this out for themselves by trial and error. But I guess the main tips around sleeping during the day are cool, bedroom cool, dark, and quiet. So anything that you can do to achieve those three things in your sleeping area, do it. Cool, dark, quiet. The reason for that is our, as I said before, when we are asleep, usually our body temperature is low, so we don't sleep well when we're too warm. Light can actually get in through our eyelids, even when they're closed, and that can actually affect sleep without us even knowing about it. So it can disturb our sleep.
I know that feeling. Your eyes are closed, but you can't really block out the light. It's sort of a red. You're almost seeing a kind of a red.
Glow. And light is an alerting signal just naturally. So it has an acute effect on our alertness levels. When my alarm went off this morning, at the low point of my circadian rhythm, my low point of my body temperature, which is like the sleepiest time for me, I switched on my light. That's the first thing I do if I have to get up early in the dark, switch on the light, because it's an alerting signal. So you want to avoid that if you're trying to sleep, of course. And then the noise, as I talked about before. If you try and sleep during the day, usually your sleep is a bit lighter and you're more easily disturbed. So anything that you can do to block out noise. At this time of the year, when it's warmer, people are often using fans or air conditioners. So they can also assist in sort of providing a white noise to block out external noises. I once had a guy tell me that he uses the radio station, but he puts it just off channel, so I don't know if that even works on digital channels, probably doesn't, but on old radios, just put it off station, so it makes that kind of
a little bit crackly,
which, you know, some people say would drive them bananas, but it worked for him. It kind of provided a white noise source and filtered out other noises.
You're listening to Overnights on ABC Local Radio. My name is Emma Crowe and my guest is Professor Sally Ferguson. She's a research professor at the Appleton Institute, a multidisciplinary research hub, and they specialise in sleep. And we're talking about shift work. I thought it was very interesting, Sally, that you talked about the temperature. And I know that from having children, we all know when part of the nighttime routine is give them a nice warm bath. But what's really happening is that when they're cooling down after that bath, that's sending their body a signal that is that cooling thing more than the warming up that's actually the benefit. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And that is very cool. That's a bad pun. Sorry. this is really interesting. So like I said, our core body temperature drops overnight and that supports our sleep. But in order for our core body temperature to fall, we have to lose heat, and we dissipate heat through our skin. So at our hands and our feet and our face are the parts of our body that lose heat the best. And so as we are losing heat, that's a good time to fall asleep. That's a strong signal to our body to fall asleep. So if you have a bath, and this works for, has been used as treatment for insomniacs as well, if you have a bath, that kind of tricks the body in to dissipating heat once you've finished your bath, and that gives the body a signal to go to sleep. It's a bit like on cold nights when your feet are cold and you can't go to sleep, and then you put socks on. I don't know if people, this is what I do, put socks on, and then that provides a signal to your body that everything's okay and it can lose heat, and then you fall asleep, and then later on you've either actually kick your socks off, or you figure out you've kicked your socks off because your feet got too hot.
Yes, I've heard about this socks trick. So people listening now who think, okay, I'm working a shift and I'm not getting the quality of sleep I want, that they might be well advised to go home, get in a warm bath, make the room dark, put some socks on, and get in a room that's quite cool, and tell the family to go out for 8 hours and go to the museum.
Yeah, I think anyone who's doing that in Perth at the moment might be thinking there's no way I'm having a warm bath and putting socks on when it's 40 degrees outside. But yes, they are strategies that can help some individuals.
So, I mean, what about, I know that people talk about strategies with shift work, and I would love to hear from you if you have strategies. You might have a surefire tip that might help others who are working shifts, might help me over the next few days as I attempt to stay up 3 nights in a row for overnights. So like some people swear by getting home from your shift, having a quick nap, waking up and then having another sleep later on. Would you say that's a strategy that can work for some people?
Emma, that's such a good question, and it is something that we talk to shift workers about all the time, when to sleep. At the moment, the advice that we provide is do some trial and error. To see what actually works best for you, how much, which strategy provides you the most sleep and has you feeling the best when you return to shift. And so that's a bit of a kind of, you know, figure it out for yourself strategy. But what is going on in our lab just at the moment is a study that's been conducted by Dr. Charlie Sargent in our lab, that's attempting to answer that exact question from the perspective of sleep strategies between night shifts. So what Charlie is doing, she's looking at three different strategies. So sleep a block as soon as you get home. That's one strategy. Sleep twice as soon as you get home, then get up and then have an afternoon nap. That's the second one. And then the third one is stay up and then have your block of sleep towards the end of your break. And so Charlie's having a look at whether those three different sleep strategies in the lab produce different performance outcomes. So I'll have to, well, maybe you can talk to Charlie in a couple of years once she's finished that study.
Yeah, that sounds like exactly what we need to know.
Yeah,
I think that third strategy sounds great, but for me, I'm thinking, grab some sleep. What if you go for the strategy number three and then you can't sleep and then you get lost all that chance to have a sleep, you know?
Exactly right. And that's the challenge, and that's a really good example of why there's not just an answer to these sorts of questions for shift workers. There are a bunch of answers, and it's kind of like, here are some ways that you could do it. Here's the pros and cons of the different ways. Some people need to wind down after a shift, so going to sleep as soon as they get home is not an option. Some people, you know, wind down on the way home. If you're commuting, you're on the bus or you're carpooling or something, so you're not sort of focused and awake, alert on the way home, so they can go to sleep a bit easier. I think that one of the things is probably worth talking about is caffeine use and how people may use, and you may be experiencing this as well, caffeine during the night.
Yes.
To keep yourself awake and alert, which then challenges your sleep if you're trying to sleep as soon as you knock off your shift. So timing, so it's a bit of trial and error as well with timing caffeine on your night shift to make sure that it's not impacting your sleep when you need to get your sleep.
Do you think that it can be a good idea to get off the caffeine and try to let your body get into some sort of other rhythm? Or do you think that caffeine, you know, especially if you're trying to do a very important job in the middle of the night, I mean, a radio show is one thing, but what if you're actually in an operating theatre, or, you know, does caffeine have a role in keeping you on the ball?
Yeah, I think, and a couple of really good points there. It depends what you're doing, of course, about in relation to your fatigue management strategies and managing your own risk of incident or error. But I think that the thing with caffeine is that we tend to use it as a, you know, social drink rather than as a bit more strategically and just use it when we need it. And caffeine is one of those drugs where you build up a tolerance to it. So if you drink a lot of caffeine, having a cup of coffee before you go to sleep won't have any impact on your sleep at all. And we definitely will hear from some people tonight who say caffeine does not affect their sleep. But I think if you use it strategically, don't just have that cup of coffee when you arrive at work, you know, at the start of the shift, whatever time that is, don't have the habit cups of coffee, then absolutely it can be a good strategy for managing alertness every now and then.
We're talking about strategies for shift workers. My guest is Professor Sally Ferguson from the Appleton Institute. And we've got Andrew on the line. Hi, Andrew. What's your strategies for dealing with shift work?
Yeah, good morning, ladies. Look, everywhere I went, I was in the military for 20 years, and we would fly through different time zones or on a ship or on a truck, and they just say, get some sleep. And one of the strategies I use, and I still use today, is I carry an eye mask and earplugs. I don't care what I look like, but it helps me get to sleep.
I think you'd probably look great.
Well, I used to write do not disturb on the front of the eye mask. It's one of those things.
Let's see what the professor thinks about those time-honoured strategies. Andrew, hang on there. Sally, what do you think about that as an idea, the old eye mask and earplugs?
Yeah, very simple, very effective. So Andrew's doing two things there, blocking out the noise and blocking out the light. And the other thing he's doing is making sure that people understand very clearly that he is sleeping. So, especially with writing "Do Not Disturb" on the front of them, yeah, very, really good strategies. And they are used by a lot of people. Some people struggle with earplugs. I think these days there are probably much better designed earplugs, a bit more comfortable. But yeah, great strategies.
And John's given us a call. John, what's your tip?
Yeah, good evening, Emma and Sally. I think the a lot of the things that you're saying is having a strategy is discipline. I certainly feel that in a routine, I've worked a 12-hour shift and I've worked night day shift in security over many years. And having a good having a disciplined routine and being focused on that and essentially valuing the sleep as the investment you need to make to be an effective resource at work. Because that really is I was in a conference late last year in November, the Circadian Institute out of Harvard in Boston. Have you heard of that, Sally?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, we saw the presentation there from the guy that runs it or whatever, but they work with NASA and air flight controllers and the military and stuff. And what they talked about is there's a way of assessing an individual's effectiveness by the biorhythms of the body and, I think, oxygen levels and things, and very small tolerances and variations. But those that are well in tune with that can go and effectively get the sleep they need for the periods of time they need and function around the clock effectively, as long as you balance your sleep, your cold environment, as you say, health and nutrition, everything in, what does it say, everything in moderation, nothing to excess. That was a long time ago, some good advice, I think, from Plato.
Yeah, interesting strategies there from John. So he's talking about a couple of things there, prioritising the sleep, actually taking it seriously and making sure you sort of invest in these strategies for making it happen, Sally.
One of the questions that I get asked a lot is, you know, how can I get sleep? And I say, get into bed. It sounds facetious, but that's one of the biggest challenges, especially these days with all the distractions that we have in our lives, and I'm talking largely about technology then, but actually prioritizing sleep, making sleep a high priority and then devoting time to it. But you need time to actually sleep, and you need to get into bed to get your sleep. And so John's absolutely right that having a routine where you wind down, you have a pre-sleep routine that involves, you know, not too much screen time and no caffeine and not too much alcohol, reading a book, an actual book perhaps, rather than your on your device. All really, really important.
Justin's with us now. Hi, Justin.
Hey, John.
Hello. So what's your strategy for dealing with shift work? What kind of work do you do?
Well, I'm a security guard, and I've just found that I go home, I have a milky drink, and I have some cereal, and I make sure I don't have any coffee. I try and have a Milo. I'm actually on antidepressants, so if I have them, I just sleep well anyway.
Interesting, Sally. So what do you think about Justin's idea, the milky drink? It's going back to what we do with the kids, isn't it? You know, what's with the milk? To talk to us about why milk helps.
Yeah, a warm milk does help, and the tone in my voice, you can tell I'm trying to remember what is in it. I feel like it might be thymine, but don't quote me on that.
Sure.
Australia. yes, warm milk is it's still a time-honoured strategy. Part of it might just be the routine of it as well. You know, it's a signal to the body and the brain that it's about to be sleep time. And so it's part of the routine as well as being a useful strategy in and of itself.
And what do you think about, exercise? What part of the day, everyone says you need to get the exercise as well, so get your body tired. You know, when do you exercise? If you're working all night, when's the best time to slip in and work out if you're that way inclined?
Yeah, whenever you can. Again, it's one of those questions that you have to kind of figure it out for yourself in relation to how close you should, in inverted commas, exercise to when you're trying to sleep. Depending on what the exercise is, if it's elevating core body temperature, then that's going to challenge your sleep a little bit more. So the advice is not to exercise within sort of 2 to 3 hours of when you're trying to fall asleep. That probably is more relevant to nighttime sleepers because core body temperature is going up in the day when night shift workers are trying to sleep anyway. And for night shift workers and shift workers who are on rotating schedules, I think one of the biggest challenges is fitting everything in. And so getting exercise into your day or maybe your week is perhaps a better option. It's just a matter of figuring out where it best works. But Emma, it's really important that people understand that exercise is good for sleep generally. So physical fitness is good for sleep, and sleep is good for wanting to engage in exercise as well. So that's a positive feedback loop between exercise and sleep for sure.
You're listening to Overnights on ABC Local Radio. My name's Emma Crowe. My guest is Professor Sally Ferguson from the Appleton Institute. We're talking about shift work. What are your strategies for dealing with shift work? Would love to hear some of your strategies. And we've got Narelle. Narelle's on the line. Hi, Narelle.
Hey, good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
I was just wondering, does it make a difference with your age, with your male or female too, at how your sleep affects you? And if you've had surgery in your life and things like that?
Yeah, Sally? Good question, Narelle. We certainly do sleep differently across the lifespan, so that's a fairly obvious answer. Kids sleep a lot differently to adults. But if we're talking about adults as we age, some sort of from, you know, post-adolescence through to older ages, yes, we do sleep a bit differently. And for as we age, we need a little bit less sleep. So they did some studies in the UK a few years ago where the ones that I was talking about before, when you put people in the lab and you basically let them sleep as much as they want to, and they showed that older people didn't need quite as much sleep as the younger groups. And as we age, the systems that control our sleep in the brain do change a little bit, and means that our sleep becomes a bit more fragmented. So we don't tend to have the long blocks of sleep that we used to when we were younger. That's perfectly normal. So more awakenings during the night, and tend to catch up on that lost sleep if we need to with naps during the day, if we can. Not too much difference between the genders in terms of sleep need though, Narelle. So sort of essentially, males and females need about the same amount of sleep.
Interesting. I wonder who gets woken up more. I feel like in my house, the gender thing comes into play because the kids wake me up when they want something.
Yeah, and I don't know of any empirical research, but anecdotally, my female friends tell me that they are the ones that hear the kids, and they are likely to be awake before their male partners, if the children are making noises. But yes.
If you've got a strategy for how to deal with shift work and getting enough sleep, the right kind of quality sleep, 1-300-800-222 is the number. We have Professor Sally Ferguson from the Appleton Institute here to help with your questions. And now we'll go to Tim. Tim, what did you want to ask Sally?
Basically, I'm Not a shift worker, I'm a retired guy, but I often spend all night up on the computer watching the American stock market and things to do with finance, but I wanted to do it all night. What I found is that if I sleep only when my brain tells me I have to sleep, then I sleep deeply, I sleep all the way through. I sleep with bright light on and a radio going in the background, and as soon as my head hits the pillow, I'm asleep. But I only go to sleep when my brain says, lie down, you have to go to sleep.
How interesting. That sounds like only eat when you're hungry, Sally.
Yeah, it does actually. And Tim is the exception to the rule, as there always is one, about being able to sleep if there's bright light and noise. But also I think Tim makes a really good point that sleeping when you're sleepy, if your life allows for that, it's probably a really good idea. People that are tuned into their body, and you know, it's a good idea to understand what your body is telling you and respond to it. But reacting to what your body is telling you is a really good idea. It's not necessarily a possibility for everybody, because you know, the alarm goes off and you have to go to work, some of us.
Hi Brian, what did you want to ask Sally?
Not so much ask. I do security like the other bloke that just rang up before, and I just found when I go to bed, since I do quite long shifts, I just make sure the keep the routine. So if I've got to go to sleep by a certain time, I'm asleep by that time, and it helps that way. But keeping the curtain closed or sunlight out as well, so the room's extremely dark, also helps sleeping through the day.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely, Brian. And I think that the challenge in Australia, where we have a lot of bright sunlight for night shift workers, is the trip home as well. So you knock off a night shift, and then you get home to a nice dark bedroom, but in between you've sort of driven home in blaring sunshine.
That's right, into the sunrise sometimes.
Yeah. Which is good from one perspective, because the light and the sun is probably helping with your alertness on the drive. But it does mean that sleep can be challenged. So sunnies, as simple as wearing your sunnies on the way home, good idea. And the routine again.
I wanted to ask about, you know, driving home. Some people their shift work is driving. We have a lot of truck drivers listening to this program, taxi drivers, security people who might have to drive to different premises. So some people are driving all night. But what about people who have worked a long shift and then they've got to get into a car and get themselves home? How much higher risk are they at of having an accident?
Significantly, and certainly if they're working a few night shifts in a row. It is a really high risk time for night shift workers, and there are lots of horror stories and horror near misses out there. A pretty good study from the Harvard Work Hours Group that was mentioned by somebody a little while ago, looking at doctors, junior doctors driving home in the States from night shift, showing a dramatically increased risk of incidents and accidents on the drive home. So it really is a high risk time for night shift workers, and anything that you can do to keep yourself safe on that drive home, do have a think about. Mm. Public transport, not always an option, particularly at that time of day, depending on what time you're knocking off, and particularly in some areas of the country, of course, you know, more regional, rural areas, it's not a possibility. So it comes back a little bit to I think what we're talking about before, managing your caffeine dose overnight. Also, nap before you drive home. That does work for some people if you get a nap during the night shift. And making sure that you have as much sleep as you can between your shifts as well.
And do we know what's causing those accidents? Is it people falling asleep at the wheel, or slower reaction time, or both?
Yeah, probably both, I think. Emma, at that time of the morning, when people have been, two things. They haven't had a sleep for a while. It's the morning hours. So, you know, people are driving home from shifts in the low point or towards the low point of their circadian rhythms. And they've been awake for a long period of time. So So those three factors can impact alertness, performance, concentration, and increase error risk.
George has given us a call. Hi, George.
G'day again, Emma.
Hello.
Just a couple of things. Firstly, a phenomenon that I sort of experienced, and I've heard a few other people talk about, where you're too tired, in a sense, to go to sleep. There's a certain kind of tiredness, and I think it's more associated with being run down rather than maybe kind of, sort of working yourself too hard at the gym or something like that. But whether that exists as a phenomenon and whether what to do about it, I mean, I think the hot bath I've tried in those situations, or another one that seems to work occasionally is, listening to the radio, but watching maybe TV, because it seems to, from what I've read, affect brainwave patterns. You go into different kinds of brainwave states, and that can kind of help snap you out of that particular kind of tiredness, but it also relates these days, I think, wider to the technology, as you say, people looking at screens all the time, and that the predominance of blue light, which mimics blue light in sunlight, which obviously would tend to wake you up and stimulate you, and particularly I've seen with younger generation, they seem to be so hyper-stimulated all the time that I'm amazed that they can actually sleep at all because they're wide.
I know what George is saying, Sally. I know that if I get on my phone and start flicking through Facebook right when I'm meant to go to sleep, often I'm exhausted and I have a little quick look at my phone and then I'm just fine. I can stay awake for another 2 hours.
Yes. Probably a few things going on there. And George raises a bunch of really interesting points there. I think that the concept of overtiredness, it's something that parents talk about in kids when, you know, children are fighting sleep, especially little ones.
Yeah, we've all heard it. I'm not tired.
Just sort of be quiet and you'll go to sleep and it'll be great. I think when people get overtired, and you mentioned before, Emma, that you're feeling a bit wired tonight.
Yeah.
And so that feeling, that subjective state of feeling a bit hyped, a bit anxious perhaps as well, all being contributed to by probably a lack of sleep. And so George alludes to there, in that scenario where you get overtired and then you're probably thinking, I really should be in bed, I've really got to go to sleep. That's not terribly conducive to going to sleep if you're just kind of telling yourself you must go to sleep. So then it's kick in those relaxing wind down routines. So the radio is a great one because it doesn't emit any light into your eyes. So certainly do have a listen to ABC radio.
Yeah, we'll try not to be too interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just it's the wind down factor.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you focus then on what's being talked about rather than what's going on in your brain.
Right. You can switch off all the little monologue in your head with all the to-do list and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And when you know that, I'm going to come back to blue light and screens in a minute. I've written that down. but when you are having a reasonably good sleep, but you've got lots going on in your life, whatever that may be, that might be home life or work life or whatever, and then you wake up and then something just pops to the front of your head and it gets stuck there and then you can't go back to sleep.
Yes.
So, you know, the stress about, you know, what's on the to-do list or whatever, calming those voices down, just explaining to them that it'll all be fine in the morning and we'll deal with it tomorrow and let's just go back to sleep. So I do, at those times, I have a pen and paper by the bed and write stuff down, get it out of my head.
Yeah. It's like, okay, everybody, we're going back to sleep. Yes. We'll all...
I acknowledge your issues and we'll deal with that in a minute.
Thank you for raising that. We'll address that at 7 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Cohen.
So quickly, the blue light in the screen. So, yes, our screens. So the advice from the sleep professor is don't take your screens to bed. People aren't going to do that. Everyone's got their screens in their bedroom these days. But please don't. Just leave them outside the bedroom. It's much better for your sleep. They do emit blue light, many of them. You can get an app put on your devices these days that will change the light, the spectrum of light that your screen puts off at night time, and so that you can go kind of anti-blue.
That's interesting.
Yep.
I think the challenge is, I know I use my phone as my alarm. That's my alarm clock. So maybe people need to go back to getting an actual alarm clock and not using that device as the alarm.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I use my phone as an alarm as well, but it goes on to, you know, nighttime mode so that it won't ring or beep or make light.
Mm. I'm talking with Professor Sally Ferguson from the Appleton Institute. We're talking about shift work and strategies for how you can deal with shift work, even observations you might have about the way it affects you. Maybe you're a shift worker just getting off your shift now or starting one. Maybe you're actually at work right now having a listen to us. Tony's got an interesting perspective. See, I can't talk now that it's getting into my shift. Tony's got an interesting perspective on this. Tony, what did you want to say?
I've been a shift worker since naturally around 20 years of age. I'm now 48, and I've done everything from factory 3 in the afternoon to 1 in the morning, baking 10 at night till whatever, and now I'm a truck driver kicking off at 1 in the morning. The one thing, unfortunately, I realised a little bit late in life is how much it affects. I've always been aware of my mood, and I can let the kids know Dad's really tired. So I'll try not to be grumpy, so please do what I asked the first time. I need to get some sleep. But the one thing I didn't pick is how it changes my, I don't know how to word this, not the perspective, but the communication between myself and my partner, as in how I would read what was being said or be able to relay what the feelings were. You know, I'd get mixed signals and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that. And it's only been the last 3 months, and I've actually, this is the first week I've come back on to 1 o'clock because I'm like, screw this, this is my business. I want to live my life and have a great time with my partner, who's a new one. And it was so much better. Now, she's overseas in Japan, and this is my first week, and all of a sudden I noticed myself getting antsy this morning, and I'm going, hang on a second. Before she left, she was doing day shift. Yeah, you're doing night shift, you're just tired, because I only get about 5, maybe 6 hours broken sleep a day. And so I'm realising that, no, hang on a second, I had to kick myself and go, no, it's you, there's nothing different.
Interesting there, Sally, from Tony, what he's saying, and I think that a lot of people would relate. I mean, I'm only doing 3 nights, and my whole family has to. I don't know where I'm going to go to sleep today. Like, right. So it becomes this big negotiation, and you're also in a different headspace to the rest of the people in your life. So you're wide awake, and they're about to go to sleep, and you've got things you need to sort out. It must be a real challenge for relationships.
Yeah, it is. That's a really great observation from Tony. And like he says, it is a shame that he kind of has only just worked it out after 28 years of shift work. But I think it's really useful for people who are doing shift work or being sleep deprived for whatever reason. And I'm so conscious of mums being up at the moment, probably feeding, who would love to give us a call and chat about this, but they can't because their kids probably are asleep.
Yeah.
But the changes that happen to our psyche, to our mood states when we haven't had enough sleep, I have warned my husband that today is going to be, like, I'm going to be, mood is one of the big things for me. If I don't get enough sleep, I get grumpy, and my sisters can attest as well. So the changes in the way that we read the play, essentially, like Tony's talking about, we can misinterpret things. Our tolerance level goes down for all sorts of things. We get way more grumpy over very small things. And that does challenge our interactions with family. So I think that just understanding that and then explaining that ahead of time so that everybody knows that this is I'm not going to be doing this because I am all of a sudden mad with you. But things are going to be slightly different today because I haven't had enough sleep. I think that's really important, that sort of communication.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've got Michael on the line. He's got another question for you.
Oh, yeah, hello.
Hi there. What did you want to say to Sally?
Well, look, I've been a night shift worker most of my life, and usually I've just sort of slept a few hours after I get home from work and then a few hours before I went to work. But recently I've been looking at, I think, what they call polyphasic sleep cycles. So basically, one I was looking at is called the everyman cycle. So you basically sleep for 3 hours in the morning and then have two or three half-hour naps during the day spaced out evenly. And I just wondered if Sally had an opinion or if she's heard of this before or whether it's just her thoughts on it.
Have you heard of this one, Sally?
Not this one specifically. Michael, the way that our sleep works is that we sort of cycle through our sleep stage. We have five stages of sleep, and they're labelled differently based on the depth of sleep, so how kind of hard it is for us to wake up from each stage. And we also have a dreaming stage where we do most of our dreaming, rapid eye movement sleep. So we have five stages of sleep, and we cycle through those stages every 90 minutes. So we kind of have 90-minute sort of blocks of sleep. And every 90 minutes, then we sort of go back to, from rapid eye movement sleep, we go back to a sort of light stage of sleep. And sometimes that also involves an arousal, an awakening, perfectly normal. So it's perfectly normal to wake up in the middle of the night and then just everything's functioning well. You kind of roll over and go back to sleep. And those arousals, those awakenings may happen without you actually being conscious of them, or you might see the clock and know that you did wake up. So we do have these sort of 90-ish minutes cycles. So the 3 hours kind of does make sense. I think that 3 hours plus a couple of half-hour naps, that's only adding up to, in my head, to 4 hours of sleep a day, which is probably, well, I would say definitely not enough. I think you'd be wanting to get a bit more sleep than that. We don't yet have super good data to know how, if you get, just as an example, if you get 6 hours of sleep, whether it is different getting it in a block of 6 hours versus 2 3-hour blocks.
Right.
And obviously that happens a lot with shift workers, as we've already talked about with the strategies, and Charlie's study is going to go some way to helping us answer that, and there are probably other studies going on around the world as well. But it's looking like it's more about the total sleep than the block, whether it's in separate blocks.
Mm.
So it's just get, I think the message there is get as much as you can.
We've only got about a minute to go, and so I've so many other things I'd love to talk to you about. I guess if you can answer really quickly, is there a limit to how long you should do this shift work? You know, should people be trying to think about not doing it for 10 years, or, you know, is there a kind of a limit to how much we really can do this?
That's such a tough question, Emma, and just such a lovely one to finish on. The research is showing that shift workers have a higher incidence of some health issues, gastrointestinal issues, in some environments, cardiovascular issues, and metabolic. There is also some data in some sectors suggesting that cancer risk is higher.
Wow.
And there are some recommendations now coming out of European studies saying that really night shift exposure should be limited. But there is not, we don't have a number on how long people should be working shift work.
Yeah.
And I think that in terms of managing risk for shift workers, it's not only about how much sleep you're getting and your circadian disruption, but it's healthy lifestyles as well. So
thanks so much, Sally.
Sure.
Thanks so much. Sally Ferguson from the Appleton Institute. And that's another podcast from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Emma Crowe. Thanks for listening.